The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, delivering gourmet recipes and fresh ingredients right to your door. Listeners get their first three meals free at blueapron.com/takeaway. That's blueapron.com/takeaway.
Hey, everybody. This is the Takeaways podcast for August the 25th. It's a Thursday.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening today. The brutality in Afghanistan continued yesterday when the American University of Afghanistan in Kabul was attacked by militants. 13 were killed, dozens wounded. This is the second recent violent event for the university. Last month, two foreign teachers were kidnapped right near the campus. The university story began in the aftermath of 9/11 and the American invasion of Afghanistan.
We're trying to build, to establish to start an American university in a war zone. And I think this is one of the best way to contribute to end this war.
That was the voice of Dr. Timo Safari, now provost at the American University of Afghanistan. The project began to take shape back in 2002 when the first independent university was proposed for the country. The idea was a chance for a Western-style liberal education and an alternative to hopelessness for at least some students in Afghanistan. In 2006, the university opened its doors for the first time. Classes for the new school year started just this Monday before gunmen stormed the campus yesterday. Majid Mishal is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. He says the university has played a crucial role in creating an educational community within a very tense area.
It has created a place for itself as one of the most prestigious institutions of learning in Afghanistan, of higher learning. But it was also seen as a symbol of sort of Western presence and sort of furthering Western ambitions. If you look at Kabul, for example, over the past several years, a lot of cafes, restaurants, hotels where Afghans and expats would mingle, would have conversations, those came under attack. So a shared space, a common space where foreigners or Afghans could share ideas, that was entirely limited over the past couple of years. And this was one place that had remained, not just as a place of quality education for some of Afghanistan's brightest, but also some of the elite, but also just this space, this secure space for young men and women to mingle and to discuss ideas. It was an oasis. It was a bubble that seems to have burst now.
The students who went there, did they see their attendance at the university as sort of a cultural act of defiance or maybe progressivism to help them bring their country to a new place? How did they view their attendance there?
I think it was more than just an act of defiance, or maybe defiance on several levels. One, if you look, there's been a wave of exodus out of Afghanistan, especially the young educated have been leaving because they haven't been seeing much hope in recent years. These young men and women stayed. And not only did they stay, but they also wanted to get the best education possible in the most difficult circumstances. So it's not just an act of defiance and resistance, but also they saw it as this larger patriotism, but then doing whatever they had here to get a good education and to stay here and to try to make something out of this country.
Describing the ongoing confrontation that you have, that cafes or places that were associated with American presence had been hit in the past, was there a security posture at the American University in Kabul that reflected that threat? It seems like in some ways, at least in retrospect, this was something that was going to happen as a matter of time.
Before I get to that, I mean, the cafes and the restaurants, yes, they're tied to this new idea of Afghanistan's new beginning that started with the U.S. presence, but it's beyond that. It's this idea of progressive, space for the young Afghans. But in terms of the security of the university, it had a pretty tight security, several layers of checks and blast walls, but almost every one of the most secure buildings in Kabul still have a corner of vulnerability. And what the insurgents do is they study their target very closely. And in this case, the vulnerable spot was a school for the blind, which is adjacent to the American University. So the understanding that we have from security officials is that the attackers came in a car full of explosives. They shot the guard in front of the school for the blind right next door. they drove the car into that school, and then they rammed it into the wall that that school shares with the university to create an opening. And then a couple militants barged in to the university, creating panic and fighting for about 8 or 9 hours.
So, Mujib, given the spirit with which many of these students go to the American university and the care they have for the future of their country, what would you expect as a reaction to this type of terror that's driven so many people from their classrooms?
I think it's a mixed reaction, and understandably so. On the one hand, just the repetition, the constant nature of this kind of unpredictable violence, shrinking the space for the young, is definitely taking a toll. But on the other hand, there's also messages of further defiance coming, that these people clearly had resisted the idea of going abroad. And if they can give up at a moment when their sort of resistance comes under pressure. So it's a mix reaction to the attack. On the one hand, you see clear signs of it taking a toll on the young, but on the other hand, there's a sense of defiance.
Mujib Mishal, reporter for our partner, The New York Times in Kabul. Thank you.
Thank you, Dad.
The American University in Kabul is one of the investments by the U.S. to offer thousands of young Afghans a Western-style education, a way to steer their country away from war. Thousands more helped the American military forces during 13 years of fighting in their country. They worked as interpreters, translators, and in other jobs to help with the American mission. And in taking those jobs, they risked revenge on themselves and on their families from Taliban insurgents or others who saw them as traitors. A special immigrant visa program has allowed Afghans who worked with U.S. forces and are at risk because of it to resettle in the United States. Now, in the past, we've reported on this show of huge backlogs in that system as Afghans who were promised a new life in the U.S. found that no visas were to be had. Now, this year, some lawmakers are questioning whether the program should continue at all. Hoja Modud Ansar moved to the United States 2 years ago through the Special Immigrant Visa Program. He's a former interpreter for the U.S. Marines in Afghanistan, and he says members of Congress have to recognize that this is not just a question of immigration. For some, it's a question of life or death.
When I heard about the United States coming to Afghanistan in 2001, I was in school. I see the peace in Afghanistan is getting worse day by day. So when I took some classes as English classes for myself, and I make myself ready to become an interpreter and translator to work shoulder by shoulder with these Americans, finally I joined them after so many questions and interview and background check. I went to Helmand province, which is the dangerous province in Afghanistan, and So it was really hard to just go and join the military and with no experience. But luckily, the captain I was working with him, very nice person, gave me the training.
It must have been a very difficult decision for you at the beginning to join the Americans and work for them, because you must have known that that decision could be very dangerous for you and very dangerous for your family.
Yes. That's what, sometimes we have to take the danger on our life to move up and do something. And that's what I took the step. And I said, I take the danger, but I'm going to work for Afghanistan. How I can sit and do nothing and stay here and let other people to move up.
Were you threatened by the Taliban? Was your family threatened?
To make long story short, I just got a threat on the first month when I started working. I was working with a mentor team for the ANP, Afghan National Police. And the next week, I just got a call from home. When I called home, I talked to my father. He was sounds different. He was like, "Where did you go?" I got some calls, and I was like, "Well, what calls did you got?" He said, "I got some calls from different people, and they gave me warning that they're going to come and kill you or something going to happen with me. They're going to come to the family." I was so shaking, and I was scared that how it happened. He said, "Some people where you're working, they recognize you. You're working with Americans." And they said, "Those working with Americans, they are infidels. It's against the Islam. He should stop working. Otherwise, we're going to send his head to you." And he was kind of crying behind the phone. And I said, "No, Dad, don't do it. I have to work. I have to stand. I took the step. I don't care about them. Let them do whatever they want to do."
Now, Ansar, you worked with the U.S. Marines in Helmand in 2011, but you didn't come to the United States under the special visa program until 2014. So I wonder what those middle 3 years were like. Were you trying to get to the United States but facing delays?
Yes, as the process said, it's going to take 2 or 3 years to do the background check and clear everything, and then you will be eligible for a visa. But those 3 years were the toughest 3 years for me in my life. I was hiding every day. I was trying to stay away from the family. Most of the time, I was going to the friend's house. I was going to be in a safe house somewhere because those people knew it about my house, where I'm living, when I'm going to go to work. And I was scared that who knows that one of these people going to throw me and just behead me. As one thing that I know from the Taliban over the past 16 years is that when they deliver a message, it is for sure that they will make it happen.
And we have talked to others on this show before about similarly situated Afghan interpreters, translators, fixers like yourself who helped U.S. forces in Afghanistan only to face either stark delays or rejections trying to get to this country after being promised that they could come. What do these delays mean to people like you, people still in Afghanistan, if the visa program isn't extended now? What does that mean for the lives of people who may have helped the United States during the war?
To make it easy and simple, they will lose their life. Afghanistan means nothing for them. They cannot stay there anymore. It's not their place anymore.
What is life like for you now and your wife? You live in Los Angeles.
I'm enjoying my life, a one-bedroom apartment, how tiny, and I'm paying $1,200, and that I'm still okay with it because I'm enjoying the peace, I'm enjoying the stability. I still work as a security field supervisor and still protecting people, want them to be safe, and I'm enjoying my life. It's good. I'm free. There's no one to treat me. There's no one to follow me. There's no one to start putting the letters behind my apartment to tell me that I'm going to behead you once American go away, or we're going to kill you. And I just scared day by day. And I'm enjoying my life. It's good. It's good for my kid. It's good for my wife. And we can go out. We can enjoy. And there's nothing to be worried about it.
There is a debate now in Congress. This special visa program is several years old. There have been debates every year about how many more visas to provide for Afghans who helped U.S. forces in Afghanistan. What is your message to those who want to end this program, who think it's no longer necessary?
My message for those, I follow the news and I see what they're saying. I wish once they go to Afghanistan as a military and they work there and they feel the interpreters that how hardly we are working with Americans there. And we are not wasting our time there. When we are hardworking and we want something from Americans to do for us, especially for those who work as interpreters and they put their lives in danger, I wish they go to Afghanistan as a military and they work with those Afghans. Once they feel them, they will never bring this to the Congress to say that we have to stop this process.
Hoja Mahdood Ansar, translator for U.S. Forces, U.S. Marines in Afghanistan, living in Los Angeles, moved to the United States 2 years ago under a special visa program that is now threatened to be discontinued by Congress. Ansar, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Conflicts and civil wars around the world have seen the horrific use of child soldiers, from Sudan's Lost Boys to the Invisible Children of the Lord's Resistance Army in Congo and other countries. Now there's a new focus on child soldiers after a recent Islamic State suicide bombing in Turkey where the bomber may have been as young as 12 years old. ISIS is increasingly relying on child soldiers. Last year, the group kidnapped hundreds of children in Iraq and Syria. The children are taken to ISIS bases where they're indoctrinated and then forced to fight. South Sudan has been dealing with this problem for years. Since the young country's armed conflict started in 2013, an estimated 16,000 child soldiers have been recruited to fight for different factions there. UNICEF has overseen the release of thousands of these children and has played a major role in rehabilitating them when they do finally return. Justin Forsyth is Deputy Executive Director for UNICEF. He recently came back from a trip to South Sudan.
Well, overall, the situation is very, very dire. There's a big outbreak of violence in July, and as a consequence of that, it's pushed the humanitarian situation over the edge. Hospitals have been looted, children are out of school, people have been displaced. And in the midst of this, all the different armed groups, both the government and the opposition, are actively mobilizing. And as part of that, they're recruiting child soldiers. You see child soldiers as you drive along the roads in these very remote areas. I was out in a place called Bentu, and I saw a lot of child soldiers who had been recently recruited.
How young are you seeing them?
Well, as young as 10 or 11, but a lot of them are 13, 14, and 15. I met one family of a child soldier and the child soldier themselves who had been recently demobilized. He was 14 and he'd been 3 years in an armed group and had to fight, had to commit atrocities, was very damaged by the experience he'd been through.
So UNICEF is one of the few organizations internationally that has any experience trying to rehabilitate and reintegrate former child soldiers after combat. What have you learned about what it takes to take these children by the hand after the horrors of combat and try to lead them toward a normal life?
Well, it's complex, and you have to understand where they're coming from. Actually, one young boy I talked to talked about being safer in his armed group because it's so insecure in South Sudan. He said he also got regular food. He also had access to his friends, and he'd fled his village with his family, been separated from his mom and dad. His dad had actually been killed. And so it created actually some stability. So one of the most important things is as you rehabilitate these children, you have to find some security for them. You have to find a way forward. Otherwise, they actually felt safer in the armed groups, especially in countries mired in conflict. So you need to do the psychosocial counseling to help them overcome the terrible things they've seen, but also things they might have done. They killed people. Some of these young boys have raped people too. And that takes many years of support to overcome that. They need to get back to school. This young boy I met, who was 14, this was his first week in school in his whole life, in his whole 14 years. You have to think about the support to their families in terms of money and food and healthcare, so they get that support going forward.
It's become clear now that ISIS in Syria and Iraq has started using child soldiers. There are suspicions, of course, that the suicide bomber in Turkey just this past week may have been a child. Is UNICEF involved in any way with helping any of these children? Do you have a way into this conflict?
It's very difficult. We work right across Syria. We work with partner organizations. We're trying to, even in those very tough places, reach out to those children to help and support them. For example, in another place where also those extreme terrorist groups are working, northern Nigeria, Boko Haram have used a lot of children as bombers. I'm reluctant to say suicide bombers because those children aren't voluntarily blowing themselves up, but they are bombers. And there's been a huge increase in the use of not just boys but girls in that situation, depressurized and then blown up, often not themselves pulling the cord, but actually remotely by some adult blowing them up in those situations. And those children, we have provided some support in terms of rehabilitation. And they're very traumatized because those children have been through terrible violent situations themselves. And they're forced to do something that they know is wrong. And then they have all the guilt that goes with it. And that takes a lot of support and counseling to overcome.
Is there anything unique about ISIS as an organization or this conflict in Syria and Iraq with this terrorist organization that makes it more difficult than Boko Haram or armies and factions in Sudan that you've dealt with that makes this an even more complicated situation to try and help some of these children if they survive?
Well, there's a similarity in that they indoctrinate the children. They use a lot of peer pressure. They force them to commit atrocities. But we've also seen that in the past with the Lord's Resistance Army, who operated and still operate in the Central African Republic, in Congo, in South Sudan itself, northern Uganda. So, in the past, we've seen these very, very violent groups that indoctrinate children. They force them to become willing soldiers by getting them to commit atrocities. And then the guilt that they play on and the psychology of it makes them the most brutal soldiers in some of these situations. And they're very young, 11, 12, 13. And ISIS and other terrorist groups are using those similar tactics, but they're not the first in history. They are very brutal. Children are increasingly being used as these bombers in these situations, and that is a worrying development.
And I take it that UNICEF shouldn't be doing this alone. Have you had contacts with other governments, with countries where these children may go, so that that kind of rehabilitation can take place in the UK or the United States or France or Germany, to where these children may end up if they survive?
Well, most of the children are helped in the countries they're from. So in South Sudan, very few of those children would get to America or Europe. But yes, some of those children do get through, they become migrants or refugees. And then, you know, also we've seen children fleeing gang violence in Central America ending up in the US. And some of those children have also been forced to commit terrible atrocities. And they're not soldiers, but they have been part of gangs. And yes, in the US and in Europe, you have to provide that support in terms of the rehabilitation, and governments play a very vital role. But I think the bigger challenge is in the regions and countries themselves, where there's much less capacity. I mean, in the area I was in, South Sudan, I went to one hospital and it had only 3 beds in it, only 1 bed in the whole pediatric ward. So, you know, you talk about psychologists or child welfare officers, there's hardly any. I mean, there's no capability at all. So you're trying to support rehabilitation of children in countries that almost have nothing. And that's where the real challenges arise.
Justin Forsythe is Deputy Executive Director for UNICEF. Justin, thank you.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, working to help Americans navigate the legal system. With assistance on business formations, wills and trusts, trademark registration, and patents, legal help is at LegalZoom.com. The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron, who knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals. Blue Apron works with a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, sustainable fisheries, and ethical ranchers to deliver perfectly portioned seasonal ingredients and easy-to-follow recipe cards right to your door. Choose recipes based on your preferences with no weekly commitment. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Have you gotten a little ho-hum lately, a little blasé about all the planets astronomers have been discovering? There are hundreds of them now, so what's one more, right? Well, what if they found a planet a lot like Earth, so close by in astronomical terms that you might be able to reach out and touch it? It's all happening. Scientists announced the discovery of a planet just like that in a neighboring solar system. It's called Proxima B, Proxima for, like, we could get there, maybe. Lee Billings is an editor covering space and physics at Scientific American. Lee, welcome.
Good to be here.
So 4.2 light years is how far away Proxima B is, and that's close.
That's very close. There's, in fact, no other star closer other than the sun, our nearest neighbor. And that's what makes this discovery so exciting, is that we know that there's tons of planets out there. We know there's quadrillions of planets, I think, in the Milky Way alone. So basically every single star has a planet, as far as we know, based on statistics. And now this is telling us that there's a habitable one, maybe habitable, right next door.
So 4 light years is still 20 trillion miles, right?
That's right.
In terms of actual exploration, maybe not by humans, but sending probes, is there a future where it's realistic to get there?
I think so. Right now, there's already efforts to do that. A Russian billionaire named Yuri Milner has started a project called Breakthrough Starshot that is attempting to develop tiny nanoprobes that could go at maybe 10% or 20% the speed of light to visit the Centauri system. So that's one possibility. And we can also look remotely through big telescopes to find out what's there.
So in addition to its approximations, its proximity to Earth, one of the exciting things about Proxima B is that it's in this place called the Goldilocks zone in the star that it orbits. What does that mean?
So it's neither too hot nor too cold for life as we know it to exist. Life as we know it needs water, liquid water. And that's what could exist in this Goldilocks zone, this habitable zone. Now, of course, there's other problems. This thing is hugging its star in an 11-day orbit. Its year is 11 days. That sounds crazy because obviously we're at a 365-day orbit around the sun. But this star is much, much, much smaller and cooler than the sun. If our sun was a 50-watt light bulb, this star would be a little Christmas tree light. And consequently, there's things like flares that happen that come out from the star and hit the atmosphere of this planet. If it has an atmosphere, it could cause problems. But it could be habitable. There could be things just like you and me there in theory.
A tiny star. It's orbiting really, really close. There could be lots of radiation. Is this a planet that we've observed directly? Can we take a picture of it? Can telescopes peer into it right now?
That's a wonderful question. We haven't detected it directly yet. What we've seen is just the wobble that it basically induces on its star as it tugs it back and forth as it whips around in this orbit. We've seen the wobble. We could get pictures using a future generation of very large telescopes on the ground that are now under construction. These things have mirrors that are around 90 feet across. We could also potentially see it using various space missions, such as NASA's James Webb Space Telescope, which is launching in 2018.
So what we've got is we've got a planet about the size of Earth, probably rocky. We think it's got similar mass to Earth, but it's hugged in so close to this star that it's basically just washed out by a massive glare and we can't see it.
That's correct. Nailed it.
And okay. And to be able to see it, though, we have missions planned to do this definitely, or this is a maybe we'll be able to observe it directly?
I think it's definitely, especially because this sort of discovery, this epochal discovery, there will never be another potentially habitable planet that is closer to us in the sky. So people are going to be pouring their resources into this, pouring their efforts into this, and that's going to let them – so they're going to find out how to do it on the ground-based telescopes and in space.
Is there a chance optically with these telescopes to tell if there is water? Can we observe that, or do we have to go there?
We can definitely tell that. I think we can do that both on the ground and from space with either James Webb or the ground-based stuff. And we could look for things like oxygen that might even be biosignatures, things that living things like you and me produce.
Possible ingredients for life in the Goldilocks zone and close by. 4 light years is nothing in astronomical terms. Proxima B is there, and it's right next to us. Lee Billings, editor covering space and science at Scientific American. Thanks a lot. It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. You're listening there to the sound of helicopters hovering over neighborhoods in the Florida Keys. It's a sound that Floridians are hearing all over their state. Those choppers now routinely spray pesticides and chemicals designed to kill both adult mosquitoes and their eggs. And this is one municipality that has the gear and apparently some money to try to stave off the Zika virus. It's an infection that's worked its way steadily north this summer. It can infect anyone who's bitten by a vector mosquito and, as you've heard, can cause birth defects in the children of infected pregnant women. Well, despite those efforts and the spraying that you heard there, Zika infections continue to grow in the state of Florida, with 43 local cases reported so far and statewide more than 500 travel-related cases, 70 of those in pregnant women. Down in the Florida Keys, the Mosquito Control Board has been trying to add a new tool in its arsenal for combating Zika mosquitoes. They're called Aedes aegypti, genetically modified mosquitoes from a British company called Oxitech. The company claims in their literature that they've reduced incidence of dengue fever transmitted by this very same mosquito by 91% down in Brazil. They say it works. The board has suggested a trial experiment with these GMO mosquitoes in the small enclave of Key Haven in Florida, but residents there are not having it.
We live in Key Haven. We do not want an English company doing business in Key Haven, period.
I'm joined now by Nancy Klinginger. She's Florida Keys reporter for WLRN in Miami. She's been following all these developments in Key Haven. Nancy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks, Todd.
Nancy, these genetically modified mosquitoes, how are they supposed to work in an ideal situation?
Oxitec creates genetically modified mosquito that cannot survive without tetracycline, which doesn't really occur out in the wild. So they release male genetically modified mosquitoes. Those mosquitoes breed with wild Aedes aegypti mosquitoes. The offspring do not survive.
So then the idea is these genetically modified mosquitoes get out into the wild and basically cause the native mosquitoes that are causing problems to be weaker and they can't live.
That's correct.
So this company, Oxitec, have they tried this method in other places? Has this ever been proven in the real world?
Yeah, they've tried it in Brazil and the Cayman Islands, among other places. And they've shown some pretty strong results in terms of knocking down the populations of Aedes aegypti mosquitoes.
So you've been talking to a lot of residents and community leaders around Key Haven. And despite the success that Oxitec says it's had elsewhere, you've found some residents who aren't terribly interested in a solution like this.
That's right. One of those was Randy Sterling.
Me and my wife, we work really hard. We paid a lot of money for our house to live out there in a nice section to raise a family, and we didn't sign up to be anybody's guinea pig.
A lot of people in Key Haven feel like this is not a test on the mosquito population, that it's a test on them, and they feel like they are unwilling test subjects, basically.
Now, what do the mosquito experts and the scientists say to that?
The scientists say that it's perfectly safe. For instance, Jack Newman, who's a microbiologist who works on vector control and treatments for malaria.
This isn't a trial on people. It's a trial to ensure that we have the most effective tools that are environmentally friendly to fight Aedes aegypti mosquitoes, should we need it for a Zika or a dengue outbreak.
Newman feels this is an important test, especially for Puerto Rico, where Zika is a real problem.
And are residents in Key Haven also scared about Zika itself, or do they think that's not enough of a threat to try something that's unfamiliar to them?
They don't really think Zika is a huge threat in the Keys. We've had one case of travel-related Zika in the Keys. And the thing about the Keys is we have a really strong mosquito control program. We have the kind of mosquito control measures just as a daily thing, and we always have, that other parts of Florida are now ramping up to in response to Zika. So we have frequent spraying in our areas. We have house-to-house inspections. We have reminders all the time to get rid of standing water. So they really feel like this isn't a threat here. Why should we be the test subjects?
So what does this come down to? There's clearly some politics involved. How is the town going to solve this?
We probably have more politics involved than most places with mosquito control because we have an elected mosquito control board. And what they've decided to do is hold a public referendum on this question, which will be on the ballot in November on the presidential election. And they are asking both the people of Key Haven and the people of the Florida Keys as a whole whether they support GMO mosquitoes. And most of the board members have said that they will abide by whatever that referendum result is.
Are we going to see a situation where Oxitec and other companies start paying money for advertising to win the referendum?
We haven't seen that yet, but there are definitely organized groups against the GMO test. They haven't put a lot of money into advertising or anything yet, but they're at every mosquito control board meeting. They're on the internet. They're on Facebook. And I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't see some money poured into both sides in a campaign on this.
And what have state leaders in Tallahassee said? Has the governor weighed in? Have other elected officials been asked to weigh in on this?
They have not. They've kind of left it to the locals. When this test was first proposed, the Key West City Commission said that they did not want to go forward with it until there was more evidence about its safety. That was long before the FDA had reviewed the test, and the FDA has now said that they're okay with it and given it their approval. But and the county commission threw it back to the mosquito control board. So I think most of the public agencies are saying, you're the mosquito control board. You guys have to deal with it.
So let's talk about tourism in Key West, because that's got to be the key industry. There is a fear that Zika will cause tourist centers like Key Haven and other places to suffer because visitors just won't want to come. That's got to be a concern as well. That probably explains why there's such good spraying. So what are locals saying about their tourism industry and the balance here?
A lot of them feel that genetically modified mosquitoes and the release of them could be bad for tourism, that people wouldn't want to come to a place where there were genetically modified mosquitoes. There's also talk about real estate values on Key Haven and whether that could be hurt by this test. And then there's people like Cindy Wensinger, who just thinks that more mosquitoes is bad for tourism, period, because they would release about 3 million mosquitoes. The vast majority of those would be male, which would not bite anybody, but she just thinks bad mosquitoes are bad for tourism.
I'm a business owner here, and putting 3 million more mosquitoes out, regardless of all the other things, benefit, drawback, whatever, 3 million mosquitoes means tourists are irritated. We don't need tourists to be irritated. We need them to keep coming down here.
Well, it sounds pretty clear that many of the business owners and residents in Key Haven think that more mosquitoes or genetically modified mosquitoes are a bigger threat than Zika, at least in their community. Nancy Klinger is Florida Keys reporter for WLRN. Nancy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Stanford University has put in place a new ban on hard alcohol at campus parties. That's anything over 20% alcohol by volume or 40 proof, so your vodkas, your whiskeys. They're also limiting the size of bottles that students are allowed to take onto campus or keep in their rooms. This is all in the aftermath of the case of Brock Turner, an athlete convicted of sexually assaulting another student at Stanford. Both had been drinking, and before getting a light sentence, Turner blamed his behavior on the school's alcohol and party culture. Now, we asked you about that.
Jerry Lynn calling from Bedford, Texas. I was not a drinker in college, but I observed many who clearly intended to use alcohol consumption as their cover for decisions for which they didn't want to take responsibility.
I'll say that I partied a lot in college. It was the 70s. It was kind of way of life then. I certainly did blame the buzz for some of the stupid choices, but I never thought that that made me not accountable for my actions.
This is Maribel from Fort Lauderdale. Alcohol is a major part of college life. Keg parties were the norm, and if you didn't participate, then there was something wrong with you.
So back at Stanford, school officials say they're trying to reduce the likelihood that students get very drunk and make very bad judgments. The question is, will it work to do that? And if it does, will that do anything to reduce sexual assaults? There are a lot of critics of Stanford's policy. Joining me is David Hansen, who's been studying collegiate alcohol policy for 40 years. He's a professor emeritus of sociology at the State University of New York at Potsdam. And also Daniel Miles, a junior at the College of Charleston in South Carolina. He's Vice President of the Campus Chapter of Students for a Sensible Drug Policy. David and Daniel, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Professor Hansen, what are these policies at Stanford and others like it at other schools supposed to do?
Well, the intention, of course, is very desirable, and it's to reduce heavy, excessive drinking. It's doing this by trying to very severely limit or prohibit the consumption of liquor or distilled spirits. I'm afraid that this policy is very likely to be counterproductive.
And why do you think so?
Well, it's based on an old myth, and that myth makes an enormous distinction between liquor or distilled spirits and beer and wine. In reality, standard drinks of beer, wine, and spirits contain the very same amount of absolute alcohol, which is 6/10 of an ounce. And so these drinks are, in fact, identical to a breathalyzer. And I think that the policy sends a very dangerous message in making and reinforcing this false distinction. There are no drinks of moderation. There are only behaviors of moderation.
Well, Dr. Hansen, the proponents of this policy haven't advertised it as a panacea. They've basically said this is harm reduction. It will help fewer students get drunk really, really fast, where they make bad calls and have bad judgment, and will help the inevitable partying on campus be just a little less intense. But you don't buy it.
I buy the goal, which is a laudable one, but I think that the approach is very, very wrong. There are alternative approaches to this problem. One of them is social norms clarification. And we know that students tend to believe that most other students drink, that they drink more often than they really do, and that they drink more heavily than they really do. Most students then want to fit in, and so they're inclined to try to meet these imagined social norms. And the social norms clarification approach is to go onto a campus like Stanford and to conduct a widespread survey of student drinking behaviors and then to widely publicize the reality, the facts on that campus. Once students realize that there's a large proportion of abstainers and that most students don't drink as often as they imagine and that they don't drink as heavily as they imagine, then students are really empowered to drink less, which is what they usually want to do.
Daniel Miles, you're a junior at the College of Charleston there?
That's right.
Well, you're familiar with the new policy at Stanford, and you're also ensconced in a college yourself. So how do you think this fits into the realities of student life and how people behave around alcohol?
It means that students are going to keep on doing it anyway. They're just going to get more punishments for them. And it means that students are going to drink more heavily at pre-games or, you know, in the, quote, underground before they go to these parties. in my opinion, as sort of a student on the ground, it really doesn't do much other than just add another punishment to the list that students are going to receive if they get caught drinking.
Professor Hansen, that's the opinion of one student on the ground. What about the data? I mean, the point here, reducing drinking is probably good by itself, but the point here is to try to mitigate the circumstances under which things like bad calls and sexual assault and inappropriate sexual behavior can happen. Do we know if it works?
We have no reason to believe that simply restricting the consumption of spirits is going to have any impact. In fact, there's a lot of research that suggests that this policy is, in fact, going to be counterproductive. We know that when people expect to be able to do something, for example, to drink spirits, and when they believe that they've been unfairly denied the ability, then they experience a reactance to this. It's called reactance theory, actually. What students and other people do is they tend to do that which has been prohibited under these circumstances as an effort to reestablish their autonomy and their freedom.
Daniel Miles, critics at Stanford, both professors and students, have reacted to this new policy, basically saying it's a way for the university to not go head on against sexual assault, that students who are convicted of it should be expelled, that the university could be doing a lot of other things besides talking about alcohol. How do you view that from where you are there in Charleston?
Well, I think the standpoint should be that sexual assault policy is not alcohol policy. Despite the fact that they're extremely interwoven, no one doubts that. Bans such as these are really going to only move the sexual assault problem further into the shadow of stigmatization. Victims of sexual assault are probably, if anything, going to be more hesitant to come out in places where these sorts of bans are in effect, because then they face another barrier, possibly more beliefs of disciplinary charges if they were to come out, admit what they were doing, and seek the help that they really need.
So, Professor Hansen, before we let you go, I just want to revisit one of the places where we started, which is that your data shows that if you survey students on how much they actually drink and then tell all the students, hey, people aren't drinking quite as much as you think they are, they might in fact drink less.
That's right. And much research has demonstrated this. Most students believe that most students drink more than they do. Once you clarify the actual facts and simply tell the truth about what's going on, that this enables people to drink at the level that they really prefer, which is almost always less than the imagined norm.
David Hansen is professor of sociology at the State University of New York in Potsdam. Also, Daniel Miles, a junior at the College of Charleston in South Carolina and vice president of Students for Sensible Drug Policy there. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And before we go, here's something you might have missed. Hope Solo, the goalie for U.S. Women's National Soccer, she's been suspended for 6 months and had her contract terminated. Why? After the U.S. was upset by Sweden in their quarterfinal match at the Rio Olympics, Hope Solo called her opponents, quote, a bunch of cowards. Now, keep in mind, Michael Phelps got equal or less suspensions for a picture of him smoking pot and a DUI in 2014. He got 3 months and 6 months for those, respectively. Ryan Lochte's lost his corporate sponsorships, but still no official punishment for him at all. Got a thought on that? You can always give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE. In the meantime, thanks for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.